Hello and welcome to BICOM's Hadiyun Weekly Podcast. I'm Richard Pater, the director of BICOM in Israel, and I'm very happy to be joined on the line by Yaakov Katz, the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, and also the author of the excellent recent book, Shadow Strike, that talks about, or looks at the events of a decade ago when Israel targeted Syria's nuclear plant in a brave operation. Yaakov, thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
My pleasure.
So I'd like to talk about a couple of things, both kind of reflect on the recent security events on Israel's northern border, and then talk about some politics as well, as we're very close to the election. If we can start with looking at this week's events on the Lebanon border, how do you assess them kind of standing towards the end of the week? Did Israel get very lucky, or was this a shrewd bit of psychops that kind of directed the IDF and led them to kind of avoid a further confrontation?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I think on the one hand, Israel had a brilliant tactic with the way it contained the Hezbollah attack, right? So Hezbollah attacks, Israel quickly choppers a couple of fake wounded soldiers from the northern border to Rambam Hospital in Haifa, stays quiet for a couple hours. I can tell you that the military censor even tells us journalists, we get a message that any writings, any reports about wounded soldiers has to be sent through them, is not allowed to be published. So it was all part of this big spin, which was aimed at making Hezbollah believe that they were wounded so that they would then stop the fire. And then only later did Israel admit. So this was like 2.5 hours later at about 6:15, 6:30 in the evening when the attack took place at about 4, that there were no wounded soldiers. But by then, Hezbollah had already stopped attacking. For them to restart again would be a bigger deal than just to continue fighting. So it was a brilliant tactic to contain it. That was on the one hand. On the other hand, they did get lucky because one of those Cornet anti-tank missiles just barely missed a military ambulance that was not supposed to be driving along the border but was found driving along the border in violation of military orders at the time. So Israel got lucky. That mistake with that ambulance could have led us, God forbid, to a larger escalation in conflict. But I think that either way, Richard, it's important to keep in mind that Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, and Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, had the same interest in mind, which is they both want to survive and they wanted to survive. Nasrallah did not want to carry out an attack that would escalate to a war that could lead Israel to bomb the bunker that he's been in for the last 13 years since the Lebanon War of 2006. And that's why he did it in the way he did it, very contained. Netanyahu wants to survive by not going to a war with Hezbollah that would be a very difficult war for Israel on the eve of an election, right? He wants to survive politically. So with both of those interests in mind, everyone had the same objective, which was to keep this at bay and not see it escalate too far.
So do you think we're all in the clear now, or how do you kind of assess the current state of tension on the border there?
Look, it's always difficult to tell, and it's difficult to predict things in the Middle East, as you well know. It seems that things for now are quiet. Hezbollah has said that the retaliation along the border was for the attack in Syria, but not for the bombing of their missile precision technology that was attacked by drones, it seems, in Beirut. So that they still are holding the right, or reserving the right, to still retaliate. They say that it might be against an Israeli drone that flies over Lebanon. We know that Hezbollah has capabilities of attacking overseas. We saw that in the 90s in Buenos Aires. We saw that in 2011 or 2012 when they attacked an Israeli tourist bus in Burgas, Bulgaria. So they do have those capabilities. We know they have cells throughout Europe, Africa, Latin America. That's another possibility. I think it's now in their court. Let's see what happens. But I don't think that anyone really has a major interest right now in a larger scale conflict. Israel has an interest, though, in making sure that Hezbollah does not get its hands on this assembly line capability to manufacture missiles that are accurate and with precision capability. So as Israel continues to act against that, that could still lead to a future conflict. So we're in a very volatile situation, but I don't think that we have a clear escalation ahead of us.
And I mean, yesterday the IDF announced one of these kind of larger facilities, factories, that was about this precision weapons, and about by exposing them, do you think that means that they can avoid it's now been decommissioned, or it's in the process of being the material being removed? Where do you see that going?
Yes, I mean, you know, if you're going to attack something, you don't announce that you know about it, right? So if Israel was going to attack, it would not have revealed its existence. It would have just bombed the place. Israel has a little more difficulty when attacking targets in Lebanon. It's not something it does. It acts more freely in Syria, and as we've seen in recent weeks and maybe months also in Iraq, but not in Lebanon. The attack that took place in Beirut, believed to be carried out by Israel, was the first time that Israel, if it was Israel, attacked in Lebanon in 13 years since the Second Lebanon War. So Israel would prefer not to have to take action in Lebanon, because that could lead to a direct confrontation with Hezbollah. But by announcing, revealing its existence, Hezbollah now has to decide what to do. If it stays there, it's vulnerable to an attack. It's already moving the stuff. That's what we're hearing from the IDF. They're already putting some of the capabilities and that technology that they had there in civilian homes and other places scattered throughout Lebanon. This battle will continue, right? And we have to make sure that Israel has the great intelligence that it's had until now. But what people also need to keep in mind, you know, as great as intelligence is, Hezbollah still has amassed a massive arsenal of missiles, more than most countries in the world have. The vast majority of countries in the world don't have 130,000 rockets and missiles in their arsenal. Hezbollah, a non-state actor, does. And they threaten us, and they're only threatening us. So as much as Israel can try to prevent and stop transfer of weapons and stop the building of this capability, Hezbollah has shown that it's able to still get stuff in and make stuff happen, even with Israel trying to, you know, stop things along the way. So I would say that Israel has to ensure its security interests, and it could be that a war now would be better than a war later on. But not that I'm advocating for war, but if there's a way to avoid that war, obviously we should do it. But we also have to make sure that they don't get this capability that would then turn this missile threat into a major strategic threat against the state of Israel.
For sure. I mean, how much importance do you place on the diplomatic role? We saw the prime minister suggesting there could be another meeting of the trilateral meeting between the US and Russia. The cynics will read this as a pure election ploy. Or do you think there's something substantial in that track that Israel can have the dialogue, particularly with the Russians?
Well, I'm probably more cynical than you are. And I would say that there's nothing that happens right now in Israel that is not political. Right. Everything that this prime minister decides to do just weeks ahead of the election, 2 weeks now, less than 2 weeks, is all aimed at how do I gain political points on this? Right. So while a tri-party or trilateral meeting would be always beneficial, right, for Israeli and American and Russian officials to sit around the same table and talk about the big issues, it's difficult to disconnect that from the fact that there is an election looming just, you know, 13 days away. I would say, though, that the Russian influence over Hezbollah is a little more limited. What, you know, Russia plays a bigger role in Syria, and that's important. And Russia also has some levers that it could move over the Iranians. America maybe a little less. But the problem with Hezbollah in Lebanon is going to be something that, you know, Lebanon needs to deal with. And, you know, the international community is working, and the French and Hariri was recently, the Lebanese prime minister was recently in America. And, you know, he's speaking with Macron, the leader of France. You know, we have to see Hezbollah has moderated to some extent because it's in power and it's in government and it knows that it has a lot to lose. And it also hears Israel's threats that a war with Lebanon would see the devastation of Lebanon, not just of Hezbollah, of the entire country of Lebanon, and they recognize that. So I don't know, you know, whether another trilateral meeting is what's going to make a difference, but obviously the international community does need to take action against Hezbollah. And more importantly, Richard, I think you get this, you know, with what you do at BICOM, but I don't think that the world completely understands this yet, is that when there is this war, God forbid, if it does happen, and Israel has to attack civilian buildings and hospitals and schools and apartment buildings and homes because that's where Hezbollah stores its missiles, you can already predict Israel's going to get hammered by the world, right? You know, for disproportionate force. They need to recognize now why this is going to happen down the line. So then when it, God forbid, if it does happen, they will know that they've received ample warning. Israel had been telling them this is what's going to happen. So that's what's important, I think, also now in making sure that that message is heard loud and clear.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. If we can turn our attention now to politics, as you mentioned, less than 2 weeks to go before the election. In a general sense, How would you assess the campaign so far, comparing them to the election earlier this year?
Well, first of all, Israel just came out of the summer vacation, and we haven't really seen the campaigns take off. I know that the big parties, definitely Likud, Blue and White, have been saving their budgets for these last 2 weeks of the campaign. And they're starting, you're starting to see more movies, you're starting to see more campaign billboards, you're going to start to see more advertisements in newspapers and on television. This is the money time, as they like to call it in Israel. And this is when it will count. The big challenge is going to be, how do we break away at this apathy that you now have among Israelis and within the public, of people who are kind of fed up and disenchanted with the political process? Say, we just voted a few months ago in April, now we're voting again in September. Why should we even bother? You know, it's a day off now in Israel, so people can go to the beach, can go on a trek, go on a hike, they could have fun, take a vacation. So the big challenge is going to be how to get voters to come out and voter turnout. And I think here you'll see a big fight between the big parties which have the infrastructure, right? Likud has the infrastructure of many, many years. And Blue and White is basing its infrastructure on Yesh Atid, Yair Lapid's part of that party, which has a nationwide infrastructure. Benny Gantz, his own little party that he joined with Yesh Atid, does not have any infrastructure. It's a brand new party. So that'll be the big battle. Look, the campaigns are going to continue. Everyone is trying to settle in to create the narrative. We know of Gantz, who just announced the other day that he's now going to want to establish a government without the ultra-Orthodox parties and just with Likud and Lieberman. If you ask me, that's an attempt to steal away votes from Lieberman, to bring them back to Blue and White, because Lieberman took away about two or three of his seats. Likud is also banking on the fact that they'll be able to steal back the two seats that Lieberman took from them. So the numbers will start to shift, I think. And as we get to the end, as we always know in Israel's elections, at least in the last 10 years or so, Netanyahu will do what we call the big gewalt, right? Which he'll yell out, you know, oh my God, and cry wolf or something. And then he'll start to get people to realign and with him. I think his aim is going to be what it's always been, which is to get to 61 without Lieberman. So just Likud, the ultra-Orthodox parties, and Ayelet Shaked's Yamina party. If he pulls that off, then he's gold. And he can not only stay on as prime minister, but probably even pass an immunity bill that would save him from indictment.
How do you rate those chances of Netanyahu getting to 61, golden 61, without Lieberman?
It's difficult to predict the way things happen. But I would say there's a good chance. I think that a lot of people look at the polls right now and they don't see it happening. You know, together, Likud, Ayelet Shaked, and the ultra-Orthodox parties right now are, you know, depending on the poll, are somewhere between 55, 56, 57. They're not at 61. I think what we need to realize is that in Israel, as you know, the number of seats that a party gets is basically the relation or the ratio of how many people voted for them out of all the people who voted. So if we have a low voter turnout across the country, but the ultra-Orthodox come out with discipline and vote, because they usually do, and they come out in big numbers. So if in this current Knesset, which dissolved itself, but they have 16, imagine they get an extra one or two seats, and suddenly they're at 17 or 18. And imagine that Likud, which is now polling at 30, 31, manages to pull back two seats from Lieberman and take away two seats from Ayelet Shaked's Yamina. So he's back at 35. Right. So now you have 35 plus 17 or 18. Right. And then all you need for Ayelet Shaked to get is 8 or 9. And, you know, she's sometimes polling at 10, 11. And you have a 61 government. So it's a little to here and a little to there. And he's over the top. And don't forget one other thing is that in the last election, you had almost 300,000 votes for the right that went to the garbage waste. Right. That went to the bin. You had the votes for Bennett and Shaked's new right party, the votes for Fagan's Zehut party, votes for some of the other small fringe parties that didn't make it in, Gal Hirsch's party, other parties. But you had almost 300,000 votes that went kaput. This time you're not going to have that. You might have, depends on what you believe in the reports, but there's the Otzma, the Kahanists. Some people say it's 70,000. Some people, they like to play it up as being 100,000. But let's even say it's 100,000. There's still 200,000 votes that are going to count this time if the people come out and vote. So if you calculate all that together, there is a chance that he gets to 61. right? And I wouldn't write that off. It could be he'll get to 60, right? And like last time, and he won't have enough. But it's also possible he'll get to 61, and then he's able to do what he wants to do.
And on the other side of the political spectrum, you met with the head of Blue and White, Benny Gantz, last week. How do you assess his capacity for leadership for the top job?
Look, I try not to, you know, voice opinions on politicians. I think that Gantz is a worthy candidate, just like Netanyahu is a worthy candidate. You know, he was a man who led the military, was the IDF chief of staff. He has a lot of experience under his belt. I mean, there's criticism of his campaign, right? It seems that his campaign has been running a little sleepily over the last few months. The same thing that we saw before the April election. I think that now they're maybe starting to pick up a little. The question will really come down to whether he's able to overtake Likud and get more votes and then be able to get tapped by the president to form the coalition, and if he'll succeed, which will be hard to see how he does that. I would actually argue that it might be in Gantz's interest for Netanyahu to get the mandate from the president first to form a coalition, for him to fail, if he does fail, and then for it to go to Gantz. And then if Gantz gets the second chance, he's almost definitely prime minister, because there will be so much pressure on all the parties to compromise and come together and form a government and not to go to a third election. But then he, you know, there's the chance that Netanyahu does succeed this time around. So this is a high stakes game of political poker. I don't, you know, it's very difficult to see how it plays out. It could be we'll be at a stalemate also, Richard. Don't forget that if the numbers come out and Netanyahu doesn't have 61 on the right and Lieberman refuses to join, then you could have this game of chicken, as we Americans like to call it, right? Where Netanyahu and Gantz both say to the other, join me, and they each refuse to join the other, and then no one can form a coalition, right? So it'll be interesting to see what happens if that does happen. My prediction would be that the president, Rivlin, would call both party heads into his office and say to them, for the better of the country or for the good of the country, you've got to come together. And at the end of the day, they'll find a way to make that happen, right? Because if Rivlin does do that, there will be pressure on them to compromise, and they'll find some sort of formula that they can sit together. Gantz will say until there's a final indictment. Netanyahu will say, I'll sit with Gantz, but Lapid would stay out. There's a lot of variables here, but I wouldn't write off that scenario either.
Great. Well, listen, thank you very much for your time today. We may well come back to talk again shortly after the elections, perhaps, and kind of talk about the forming of the coalition, whoever does it. But in the meantime, thank you very much indeed. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.